I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. Well, I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about a historical topic that is incredibly important for understanding maybe the most significant event in the history of our world, World War II, and the effects, the resonance that that has on our lives and our world today. We're going to be talking about General MacArthur's return to the Philippines at 80 years. It's been 80 years since many of those significant moments in World War II. And what does it mean for us to understand those? What do they lessons do they have for us? And what do they show about the history and times of that incredibly important era in America's history and the history of the world? Those are some of the questions we're going to be talking about today with our guest, Walt Borneman. Walt is a historian, a lawyer, an author, a prolific author. Many of you, I'm sure our listeners, know some of his books. Just to give you a few, and there are many and many, many good ones, and I highly recommend anything that Walt's written, you need to be reading. Rival Rails, The Race to Build America's Greatest Transcontinental Railroad. His book on James K. Polk called Polk, The Man Who Transformed the Presidency in America. Of course, a lot of our listeners know his book, The Admirals. Nimitz, Halsey, Leahy, and King, the five-star admirals who won the war in the Pacific. All of these books and many others worth reading. And I want to mention in particular his new book, tentatively entitled Reckoning, The American West on Edge. I think Walt is a Westerner and brings that interest in Western history to his thinking and to his studies. Walt Borneman, thanks for taking the time to be with us today on The American Idea.
Well, Jeff, thank you for having me. It's great to join you to talk about a pretty fascinating individual and certainly, as you suggest, a defining period in Americans' global history.
The MacArthur's return to the Philippines. Return suggests that he left. Now, a lot of our listeners are very historically well-informed, as you know, but maybe not everybody understands the circumstances under which MacArthur was originally in the Philippines in World War II and the circumstances of his departure.
Well, sure. Maybe a brief bio to Douglas MacArthur. You know, he's born in 1880. And if there's anything else that we can say about Douglas MacArthur, it's really that he's a 19th century personality. He's somebody who really thinks in terms of the 19th century. So he's going to have to be kind of drug into this whole period of modern warfare that World War II ushers in. Well, he goes to West Point. He serves in the First World War. He commands a brigade in the famous Rainbow Division during World War I. Then he goes back to West Point as superintendent. And after that, he becomes an Army Corps commander. And eventually, Herbert Hoover appoints him as chief of staff of the U.S. Army. Franklin Roosevelt keeps him on for an additional year beyond his four-year term. And then MacArthur, who has actually served in the Philippines previously, what's he going to do? He's only in his mid-50s. He's really advanced through the grades rapidly. So he wants to return to the Philippines. And the Philippines, which at that point is a territory of the United States, nonetheless has its own local militia force and standing army, and they ask MacArthur to come back to the Philippines and basically become a field marshal and take charge of the defense of the Philippines. You got to remember that this is, by this time, the late 1930s. So there's already a war in the Pacific between Japan and China. And Japan has its eyes on the Philippines next. So what happens is MacArthur in the summer of 1941 is actually recalled to active duty in the US Army, and he is the one, not only for the United States, but also for the territory of the Philippines, the main person in charge of defense in the Philippines on that morning of December 7th, 1941, which is actually, with the time change, December 8th in the Philippines. Japan attacks. We can talk about that, Jeff, in some detail if you wish. Japan attacks. A lot of MacArthur's airplanes are caught on the ground. A very rapid invasion occurs, and of course, then there's the famous retreat to Bataan, the infamous and rather horrendous Bataan Death March. And the long and the short of it is Franklin Roosevelt, in March as president, in March of 1942, orders Douglas MacArthur to, quote, break out of the Philippines and retreat by himself and a small staff to Australia. And we're going to talk a lot about sort of the more glorious periods in MacArthur's life, the good things that he did. But let me just suggest to you right up front, this retreat from the Philippines by MacArthur in a PT boat through choppy seas, horrendous weather. The man is 62 years old, which for the time, I mean, that's a decade younger than I am at this point, but that's for the time, that's a relatively old man. And that's really the low point of, I think, his career. He's in defeat. He's going to Australia. And when he gets to Australia after a difficult plane flight and rail journey, he's almost to Adelaide on the southern coast of Australia. And he utters those relatively famous words, I shall return, when he's asked about why are you here? What's going on? What's the fate of the Philippines? George Marshall, Army Chief of Staff, and Franklin Roosevelt try to kind of convince MacArthur to say, well, couldn't we kind of edit that and say, we shall return as the American people? But no, I think that says a lot of MacArthur's personality, his proclivity to singular pronouns. And yet, I shall return really sets up the story in a nutshell of the next 2 years of the war in the Pacific until he finally does 80 years ago this month.
Let's talk a little bit about the initial Japanese invasion. Why does it catch MacArthur so off guard? Was that symptomatic of all U.S. forces? I think we think December 7th, we think of Pearl Harbor and only Pearl Harbor. We forget the multi-pronged Japanese attack in the Pacific. Tell us about that Japanese attack on the Philippines.
It was definitely multi-pronged, and I think MacArthur definitely anticipated some level of assault against the Philippines. But he actually thought, and he's on record telling a British admiral just a couple of days before, I think the war will come in the spring. Well, that was 4 months away or whatever the calendar. And I think that, like most forces, and of course, the British forces in Malaya were also taken by surprise. No one really quite understood, and certainly Pearl Harbor is the classic case of it in terms of what air power and carrier-based air power can do. There really was no expectation by MacArthur that there was going to be that kind of assault. And by the way, it's kind of interesting that MacArthur later, and sometimes there's a lot of different myths to MacArthur we could talk about, but one of which was that he was sort of left out there on his own in the Philippines. Well, believe it or not, from a preparation standpoint and the kind of supplies, and I'm thinking now P-40 fighters and B-17 bombers, the Philippines was actually one of the best supplied locations in the entire Pacific from the American standpoint. And yet, when we talk about, I think part of the amazing story about Leyte that we're going to get into and MacArthur's return there is that on December 8th, 1941, MacArthur's heavily supplied in the context of the time, but he still only has 16 B-17 bombers at his command.
16 for the entire country.
For the entire country of the Philippines.
Wow. So as you say, the America is just simply unprepared in materiel and strategy and preparation for that kind of Japanese invasion. MacArthur successfully makes it to Australia. He says, "I shall return." You said something really interesting. That would define much of the war in the Pacific for the next 2 years. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think at two levels. I think at a psychological level, it defines the spirit of not only the Americans, but the Allies. You got to remember that Australia, even though sometimes MacArthur kind of pushed them aside in the glory moments, Australia has a lot of not only territory, but also troops involved with this. So when I talk about it from a psychological and a psyche standpoint, it's not just the Americans, it's the Allies generally, this concept that I shall return, we shall prevail across the Pacific. That's the importance at the psyche level. Now, the second thing is that we need to remember that Pearl Harbor is thousands of miles to the north and east, of course, but it sets up over the course of the war, two dual avenues of advance against Japan. One is definitely westward from the Hawaiian Islands. We've got in June of 1942 the great victory at Midway that Chester Nimitz organizes. And the Central Pacific that Admiral Nimitz commands is going to be one of those dual avenues. We're going to go to Midway, of course, hangs on. We're going to go beyond Midway to Saipan and Guam after going through the Marshalls. So that's a Central Pacific advance. But the other thing that I think I Shall Return sets up, and the reason I make that comment, is that MacArthur is always going to have that second track, the second piece of the dual advance, which is going to be from the Southern Pacific, places like Guadalcanal, and really the extent of stopping the Japanese advance, which, by the way, was really never ever aimed just because of the logistics in terms of capturing Australia. But certainly the Japanese proposed to advance beyond Guadalcanal and cut the Hawaii and West Coast to Australia lifeline. So having succeeded in not permitting that, having pushed the Japanese back at Guadalcanal, it falls to MacArthur to undertake that second dual advance toward the Philippines and eventually to Japan.
Tell us then about MacArthur's advance back toward the Philippines. What are some of the most important moments in that?
Well, the first thing that occurs is really on the island of New Guinea at a place called Buna, B-U-N-A. And again, when we talk about those 2 years of World War II, I think there's a great theme of how rapidly and how totally America's great industrial strength really comes online, and what we as a country are able to do over that period of time. MacArthur, in terms of supporting Australian troops, again, mostly at the Battle of Buna, and there's a place called the Kokoda Trail where the Japanese are trying to attack south and basically control New Guinea. He's fighting almost at the company and maybe battalion level strength. I mean, 1,000 troops against equal numbers of Japanese in some of these battles. So that occurs over the period of the late summer. Same time the Marines are fighting on Guadalcanal, MacArthur's fighting at Buna at a very low strength level. And over the course of the next couple of years, we're going to talk in a second about the numbers at Leyte when he makes his return. But those are the kind of things that start out very small, limited number of transports, a couple of destroyers. And beyond New Guinea, MacArthur's going to look at the map and say by March of 1944, he's going to invade the Admiralty Islands. And again, at that point, he's got a few thousand troops that are going in there. And yet by the fall, it's going to be much more when he invades Leyte. So he begins to go to Buna, onto the Admiralties, work his way across New Guinea.
And is he doing this at this time? How much is MacArthur himself involved in the South Pacific strategy? Is he carrying out someone else's strategy? Is he running the strategy himself? Or is there some interplay between him and the higher command?
That's an excellent question. And you know, from MacArthur's standpoint, he would suggest to you, Jeff, that he was calling all of the shots and laying everything out. But it's actually the American Joint Chiefs of Staff that include Admiral King on the Navy side and George Marshall on the Army side, who have decided really early on, in fact, as early as December of 41, when Winston Churchill comes over and spends a few weeks with Roosevelt at the White House, that America's major strategy is Germany first. We're going to defeat Germany, and then we're going to look to the Pacific. But Admiral King, to his credit, and I think it's an overlooked piece of American strategy, Admiral King says, hey, look, we've got to do both. We're going to put men and resources, materiel into the Pacific. And again, MacArthur, in some of his perhaps less grand moments, is going to complain and say, hey, well, I was left out here with nothing. But actually, he owes quite a bit to Admiral King for putting resources into the South Pacific. So it is definitely true that MacArthur, as a theater commander, is going to call the shots as to when we invade, what island when, usually, but he's doing so within a broad framework that the American Joint Chiefs of Staff have basically set down and dictated. And in fact, even when it comes to the exact date of returning to the Philippines, you know, they will basically okay that with MacArthur, but give the go-ahead, because again, they're the ones pushing the resources into his theater.
What's his relationship like with the Joint Chiefs and people like Admiral King?
I think one of the myths is that somehow MacArthur and the Navy didn't get on well with one another. And I think that's definitely true. And I write about it in both MacArthur and at War and the Admirals as well. I think
it's an old theme about ground forces and naval forces.
Absolutely. It's an old theme, a recurring theme. And I think particularly at the staff level, you know, they're always fighting for this or fighting over harbors or whatever. But at the main level of MacArthur dealing with his peer, if you will, in Chester Nimitz, and also his peer in terms of a regional commander, in terms of Admiral Bill Halsey, I think both of, or let's say among those three, there was a lot of respect for one another. And particularly Halsey and MacArthur, who could both be both curmudgeons and, you know, have issues and be media types and everything. I think there was a lot of mutual respect that at the end of the day, they recognized that each of them was a fighter determined to drive home to victory, and they respected that.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
So the tide, of course, is turning for America, not only in Europe, but of course, also in the Pacific over 1943, particularly 44. And you mentioned the increase in the size of MacArthur's forces as 1944 goes on. Take us to the point where we're getting up to his actual return, the invasion of the Philippines.
Well, you know, I've written that 1943 is sort of a year of preparation, and 1944 is definitely a year of attack. And again, this theme, Jeff, of what America's able to do in terms of this outpouring of industrial strength, the United States is going to launch and put into service 16 major aircraft carriers in 1944. Never mind the escort carriers and the smaller, they called them light carriers, but major carriers. And when we talk about Halsey and having these carriers and the strength of the Third Fleet going into the Philippines, this is significant. And again, the same thing is happening across the Central Pacific. Nimitz is going to have, roughly 125,000 men when they invade Saipan and go into Guam. But by the time MacArthur is ready to go into the Philippines, he's got 200,000 ground troops, some 600 vessels, combat vessels, 600 vessels that include supply ships and everything, but an additional 100 combat vessels of Bill Halsey's Third Fleet. And the interesting thing, and this sort of sets up originally the Joint Chiefs, and there's been kind of debate of whether they should adhere to MacArthur's theory to go back into the Philippines, or Admiral King at one point and a couple of others want to actually kind of leapfrog and go into Formosa, which is north of the Philippines, under the theory that they can cut some supply routes. Japan, you know, is getting a lot of its natural resources and war material from the Dutch East Indies. So they think that Formosa would cut off that avenue. But Halsey's staging aircraft raids, and of course, MacArthur wants to return to the Philippines, telling Roosevelt, you know, man, we have a moral commitment to these people. And of course, he wants to honor his personal commitment. So the Joint Chiefs have said, great, let's return to the Philippines in December 20th, 1944. Well, Halsey's got his fleet out there and flying all kinds of airplane sorties. And again, Jeff, 1,200 sorties are flown by Halsey's fleet in September of 1944, just in a single day against the Philippines.
Amazing numbers, now, yeah.
16 B-17s at the beginning. So Halsey recommends to Nimitz, and Nimitz recommends to the Joint Chiefs, why wait until December 20? Let's expedite this timetable. Halsey calls it an empty shell. We're going to talk about the hand-to-hand fighting and ground fighting on Leyte in a little bit. But Halsey recommends, he calls it an empty shell. He recommends to the Joint Chiefs, let's go ahead and expedite, which is why we're talking now in October as the 80th anniversary. It's October 20th. That the date for MacArthur's return has been expedited to, and that's the date of the invasion of Leyte.
So, of course, during this time, Obviously, the Philippines itself is under Japanese occupation. And my father-in-law was actually born in 1933 in the Philippines, Filipino. His family lived during the Japanese occupation. He would talk very, very little about it. And I sensed that there were some very terrible things, and we know historians have documented terrible things. But for our listeners, tell us about the circumstances in the Philippines during Japanese occupation.
Well, it was a very horrific time. You're right. There were certainly atrocities on the civilian population. There were many people in internment camps. You got to remember, there are a whole number of Americans, depending on what period you talk about, because an awful number died in captivity. But the survivors, the people who surrendered, American troops on Bataan after the Death March, there are POW camps where they are languishing as well. And MacArthur, in particular, felt, I think, a personal responsibility and moral obligation to do something for them. Now, we know that there are POW camps all over in Europe as well that factored into who got liberated first and that sort of thing. But MacArthur feels very strongly that he wants to return. And of course, he's got a fair amount of his life. His son is born in Manila. He's got a fair amount of affection for the city. Unfortunately, and this jumps ahead a little bit, but the battle for Manila in January and February of 1945, after his return to Leyte, is going to be horrific in terms of civilian casualties and what happened to that city.
Well, then take us, though, to October of 1944 and MacArthur's return in Leyte.
Again, MacArthur has a huge number of troops, some 200,000 ground troops, 600 ships. They sail into the waters of Leyte Gulf. Leyte is one of the main islands of the Philippine archipelago. It's south of Luzon, which is the big island where Manila is. And it's kind of interesting in terms of why Leyte. The Joint Chiefs thought that Leyte would be a safer bet than going direct to Luzon. And it would sort of give them a toehold where Luzon would be much more susceptible not only to the Japanese reinforcements for the troops that were there, but the operations of the Japanese Navy as well. So they picked Leyte in as a place to go in. And interesting from the Japanese side, and the Japanese general there is a man named Yamashita. Yamashita is convinced there's going to be a do or die struggle for the Philippines, but he simply assumes that he's going to fight it on Luzon at some point. But what happens is that with MacArthur on Leyte putting more troops in there, the Japanese really decide that they need to reinforce their troops on Leyte. And over the course of, November and December of 1944, after MacArthur's initial return, there's a tremendous amount of Japanese troops that are pushed into Leyte. So the fight for Leyte becomes one of the hardest and most difficult that MacArthur faces. And of course, I guess the cornerstone event, if you will, from MacArthur's standpoint, is that after his troops go ashore, on October 20th, 1944, by that afternoon, there he decides to go ashore from his headquarters on the cruiser Nashville. And there's the famous scene of him wading through the surf. He's got his staff, he's got people of the Philippine Army staff. And really, with understandable emotion, the reports showing his hands shaking a little bit and emotion in his voice when he proclaims, "People of the Philippines, I have returned." And again, that sets up not only militarily this continued advance and ultimately the liberation of the Philippines, but that does a lot for the psyche, we shouldn't overlook there's a lot of guerrilla activity in terms of resistance in the Philippines. That I have returned really gives a little boost to continue that opposition and be able to hold on until MacArthur completes the liberation.
Well, as the Japanese reinforce the positions there, what are the conditions like for Americans and I guess their Filipino allies fighting? What's the actual hand-to-hand infantry combat that's happening there?
Well, you know, MacArthur, despite the fact that sometimes it's that he's the sole person involved, MacArthur, to his credit, really has always done a wonderful job of what I would call and what today everybody knows is joint operations. So he has a great man, George Kenney, in charge of his Air Force, Kincaid in charge of the Navy, Kruger and Eichelberger are going to command his ground troops. But the point I guess I want to make, which does lead to some of that hand-to-hand, pretty grisly fighting in the jungle that you reference, is that Leyte is one of the few places of all the islands that MacArthur's forces invade that he is unable, or Kenny, his air chief, is unable to establish air superiority really early in the campaign. Couple of reasons for that. One is the weather on particularly the eastern side of the islands in the island of Leyte, kind of a rain curtain. So on MacArthur's side, it's raining cats and dogs. And the other side, the Japanese can mount all kinds of air operations. So MacArthur's Air Force is not only unable to fly, but the Seabees who are in there trying to construct airfields for him are having a difficult time doing that. So Japan, in terms of mounting its assault against the beachhead, is really able to, if not superiority, challenge the American flyers for control of the sky for a good number of weeks early in the campaign. And that, of course, bogs down the ground forces. So it's wet. It's miserable. It's a tough slog in terms of being able to do anything. And the twin beachheads that MacArthur establishes start to fight their way, one counterclockwise, the other clockwise from the east around the island. But it's really not until almost Christmas time, December of 1944, when, as you say, in Europe, the Battle of the Bulge is happening, that MacArthur is able to kind of surround the island and finish off his bulge, if you will, in terms of the Japanese reinforcements that have gone into Leyte at a place called Ormoc.
So then, of course, the push is on to Luzon and Manila. Tell us about the struggle that happens then in early 1945 as MacArthur continues his advance.
Well, MacArthur wants to return to Manila, of course, and they land in early January of 1945 at a place called Lingayen Gulf. If you look at my book, The Admirals, that line of battleships that's on the cover is actually going into the Lingayen Gulf. And the interesting thing, again, I don't mean to overstate it, but it's a fact. America's industrial strength, those battleships that are in that line, many of them, including leading the line, the USS Pennsylvania, are survivors from Pearl Harbor. We know we lost the Oklahoma and the Arizona, but the rest of those battleships attacked at Pearl Harbor are active in the Philippine campaign and central to MacArthur's return. So the Navy leads the way into Lingayen Gulf. The troops under Walter Kruger and his Sixth Army land, begin a really fast march toward Manila. And once again, MacArthur's really up at the front saying, come on, you know, we got to do this faster. And yes, a little bit of it is, again, there's an ego part, certainly, to return to Manila. But very definitely, there's also a caring part on his part as to what's going on with the civilians. What's going on with the POWs? How can we save the city itself? And of course, the Japanese, rather than retreating from Manila, really decide to hunker down. And again, it's hand-to-hand fighting before MacArthur is actually able to retake the city. There's another assault then that's led by paratroopers that come in from the south, and there's a kind of a pincer movement to finish off the Battle of Manila then by March of 1945.
So during this time of the assault, from October of 44 all the way through March of 45, do we know anything about what the Japanese themselves thought of MacArthur?
Well, I think the Japanese, particularly Yamashita, had a lot of respect for MacArthur. They certainly consider him, obviously, the enemy. There's not the reverence that's going to be attached by the Japanese people to MacArthur after his administration of Japan at the end of the war. And of course, contrast that the Filipino people will always view and revere MacArthur as someone who came back and basically lifted their enslavement by the Japanese. And remember that then, you know, making this come full circle, even though the Philippines have been a colony of the United States during the period we're talking about, the Philippines after the war are very rapidly going to be given their independence. Like so many countries, they go through a number of cycles. But I would just fast forward to 2024 and note that the Philippines are definitely, once again, a key American ally when it, along with Vietnam, when it comes to what the Chinese are doing in the South China Sea and the Spratly Islands.
The victory, ultimately, of MacArthur in the Philippines, does it make the myth of Douglas MacArthur?
I think I Shall Return makes a lot of the myth of Douglas MacArthur. And again, I think that part of that is the American people in those dark days of late 1941 and 1942 are desperately seeking a hero. And Douglas MacArthur, for better or for worse, and you know, there are the pros and the cons, but at that period of time when America needed a hero, Douglas MacArthur fit the bill and was able to provide that. Sometimes the Navy, in particular Admiral King, didn't want any publicity, didn't want anybody to telegraph where they were. But everyone knew where MacArthur was, originally in the Philippines, and then he escapes to Australia and is talking about going back. So I think there's a huge element that is part of the psychological winning of World War II that stands squarely on MacArthur's shoulders and his comment that I shall return, even though we know in the broadest sense it was not only we, the American people, but we, the Allies, who returned to the Philippines.
You've had a chance now to study MacArthur at some length in your books and in your own historical studies outside of this book. What's your verdict, if this is a fair question? What's your verdict on Douglas MacArthur?
Well, I've said many times that there is no middle ground with Douglas MacArthur. I've tried to present in MacArthur at War a balanced view, because I think he did some very good things. On the one hand, I've pointed out that I thought his embrace of joint operations was critical to the success of the war in the Pacific, even though he sometimes maybe exaggerated what he did with fewer casualties. He actually had a number of casualties, but deep down, MacArthur really cared about the troops under his command. Those were some of the good things. On the other side, there's no question that he was entirely egotistical. He phrased things with almost kind of a complex of persecution that simply didn't exist. Again, we've talked that he got the men and material thanks to Admiral King. George Marshall and Roosevelt kept him informed. If you listen to MacArthur, you would think that no one ever talked to him, and he said that. But the record shows almost daily communications from Washington to him. So there are these polar opposites, almost, if you will, that pull apart and leave no middle ground. But certainly, for what was necessary and what was needed by the American people in 1942 in particular, Douglas MacArthur played a central role in energizing America to win World War II. And certainly, I would suggest the cornerstone of that 80 years ago this month is indeed his return to the Philippines at Leyte.
Fascinating. Well, wow, what an interesting conversation. To our readers, let me recommend all of Walt Warneman's books, but in particular for this conversation, MacArthur at War, World War II in the Pacific, and his new book coming out when, Walt, we hope?
It's a work in progress. I'm working my way toward it. No
when
date.
When it comes out, of course, for our listeners, it's called tentatively Reckoning, the American West on Edge. What a great conversation. Walt, thanks for taking the time to take us back 80 years to this really important time in the history of America and in the history of the world. Walt Warneman, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Thank you, Jeff. Good to be with you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.